quietly and effortlessly as Sappho did. "The women of Lemnos?" I said. "Let me think. Every Greek island has numerous stories attached to it, and there are a great many Greek islands. Even Homer couldn't have known all their stories. It's part of the tale of Jason and the Argonauts. They stop at Lemnos on their journey." "Ah, yes, it comes back to me. There were no men on the island, only women. But I can't recall why." "Because the women had killed all the men." Sappho finally turned her gaze to Davis and smiled, for my son-in-law looked quite appalled at such an idea. "Well, not quite all of them. And thereby hangs the tale." "Which you are about to tell us, I hope. It's always good manners to encourage one's host or hostess when they seem ready to tell you a story." "The trouble began when the Lemnian men sailed off to make war," she said. "When they returned, having slaughtered a great many Thracians, they brought back as booty all the possessions of those they had killed, including their daughters and widows. But instead of treating the Thracian women as slaves, the Lemnian men took the most beautiful of them as second wives. They lavished all their attention on their new brides and treated the Lemnian women like servants. Any who dared to protest were thrown into the streets, along with their daughters, reduced to beggars. The Lemnian women were furious. They held a secret meeting at a clearing in the forest. Among them was the unmarried daughter of the king, the princess Hypsipyle, attended by her nursemaid, Polyxo. I saw the slave look up at the utterance of her name, then look elsewhere as Sappho continued in her elegant Greek. So furious were the women of Lemnos, they decided to kill every man on the island, even the old men, even the little boys. "But that's terrible," said Davis, whose Greek was surprisingly good. "Tell me that the princess stopped them." "No, she didn't. Their wrath was too great to be stopped. They disbanded and went their separate ways, each going home to slaughter the males of her household. Wives killed husbands, sisters killed brothers, mothers killed sons, daughters killed fathers, and, of course, the new Thracian wives were killed as well. All the Lemnian women took part in the massacre, all except Princess Hypsipyle. She, too, was caught up in the madness until she saw a friend, a girl no older than herself, walking through the streets carrying the severed head of her own father. Hypsipyle loved her father, King Thoas. With the aid of her nursemaid, the loyal Polyxo, she contrived to smuggle him off the island. While the other women raged through the streets like frenzied maenads, covered with blood and gore, and crying out to Bacchus to bless the slaughter, Hypsipyle dressed her father in the ivy wreaths and sacred robes of Bacchus, covered his face with a mask of the god, and led him onto a wagon. While King Thoas stood upright, impersonating a statue of the god, donkeys pulled the wagon through the streets, thronged by the Bacchic worshippers. The wagon reached the deserted outskirts of the city. Hypsipyle led her father into the woods and down to the seashore. They waited for days, attended only by Polyxo, who smuggled food and drink to them until at last a ship sailed close enough for Hypsipyle to summon help. The sailors agreed to allow her father aboard and to take him to safety. By the time Hypsipyle returned to the city, the frenzy had died down. The corpses of the dead had been burned. Not a single male was left alive. She was declared queen and ruled over an island of women. Nor did any men dare to stop at the island, because the sailors who rescued King Thoas spread the news of what had happened. For years the women lived without men, unmarried and childless, until at last Jason, ignorant of the story, decided to cast anchor off Lemnos. "And then what happened?" said Davis, who stared at her spellbound. "What happened next is another story," said Sappho.
"You tell the tale very well," I said. "I think you must have inherited your father's gift for storytelling."
"Do you?" "My father always hoped it would be so, I think. Why else did he decide to call me Sappho when I was still just a child? I do attempt to write poetry from time to time, mere trifles, nothing worth reciting, certainly nothing to compare to the work of my namesake or the work of my father."
"Few poets can be compared to Sappho of Lesbos or to Cinna of Rome," I said. "Still, there must be room in the world for other poets and other poems. I would be honoured to hear some of your verses."
I thought my words would please her. Instead, her proud bearing vanished, and she turned bright red. She averted her eyes and stuttered. "No, no, no. That would be impossible.
She folded her hands in her lap and took a deep breath.
"The point of the story was to explain my father's inspiration to name my nursemaid Polyxo. Her Nubian name was something impossible to pronounce, and not pleasing to the ear, gibberish, as my father would say. So he gave her the name of the loyal nursemaid of Lemnos, who helped a devoted daughter to save the life of her father. A lovely gesture, don't you see? My father would make everything around him, his life, his house, his household, a work of art, as perfect and pleasing as his poems. What more appropriate name for his daughter than Sappho? What better name for my nursemaid than Polyxo?"
She had regained her composure and again stared at me.
"Is my father in danger, do you think?"
"I beg your pardon?"
"The word that was written in the sand in front of our doorstep. Beware, in Greek. What do you make of it?"
"Did you also see it?"
"I did, before father scratched it out."
"What do you make of it, Sappho?" She sighed, then shrugged.
"They call you Finder, don't they? Is that why father asked for your advice about the warning?"
"I suppose it is." An awkward silence ensued, for I hesitated to share with her my private dealings with her father.
"What are you thinking right now?" she asked.
I smiled. "I was thinking that you women often know more than we men give you credit for, and you do things about which your menfolk know nothing. My own wife and daughter have surprised me sometimes, and not always in a good way. You have your own ways of knowing."
"Our own ways?"
"Witchcraft, I mean. There, I've said it. Magic, sorcery, spells. Every woman resorts to the supernatural from time to time."
"Yes, well, Papa writes a bit about that in the Smyrna, doesn't he? When the nursemaid helps Smyrna to summon the courage to go to her father the first time, she says to her, 'Spit three times into your hand, virgin, like this, watch me. Jupiter Magus, king of sorcery, delights in the number three.'"
"Yes, I remember that part," I said.
"As I do," said Cinna, stepping into the room.
"But I don't think I've ever before heard the epithet Magus attached to Jupiter," I said. "Do women in their secret rites really call on Jupiter the magician?"
"I have it on good authority that they do," said Cinna. "A great deal of research went into that poem, one of the reasons it took so long to write. But don't tell me the three of you have been talking about nothing but the Smyrna since I left you."
I shrugged. "We talked of many things, such as—" He clapped his hands, too excited to hear me out. "But I have news, splendid news. Not only am I travelling to Parthia, a message from Caesar himself confirms it, but I am to join you and your son for dinner with Caesar tomorrow night.
Splendid news indeed, I said.
Cinna paced about the room, too excited to sit. I'd never seen him so animated. I was struck by how handsome he looked, with his eyes ablaze and a broad grin on his face.
But look at you, Gordianus, dressed in my summer toga. Stand up so that I can see you. Yes, turn around for me. The garment fits as if it were tailored for you. With that toga and a trim to neaten your beard, you shall look quite presentable on your first day as a senator. Now, if only you can assume the pompous bearing of a senator, people will think you've been one all your life. That may take some practice.
Should I wear the toga tomorrow at the dinner?
I think not. The occasion will be elegant, but not formal. Let Caesar see you in that toga for the first time on the Ides. I think he'll be quite happy to see the last of his new senators turned out so smartly, an omen that the rest of the day's business will go smoothly.
Is there any reason to think it won't?
You never know. This will be the last chance for the envious and the grudge-holders to express their discontent before Caesar leaves Rome. Who knows what mischief they might get up to?
Day 5, March 14th. Chapter 26. The next morning, Bethesda and Diana descended on me as the harpies descended on the feast of Phineas. No visible part of me was left ungroomed. My hair was washed and combed, then given what Diana assured me was a fashionable cut for a man of my age and station. My beard was also neatly trimmed, as were my eyebrows, and various hairs were plucked from various places, where hairs tend to grow as a man gets older, such as his ears. My nails were also trimmed. With the help of a slave, I donned the toga Cinna had given me. Diana clapped her hands with joy. Bethesda looked ready to swoon. But as I paced back and forth across the garden, trying to assume the pompous bearing Cinna had talked about, Diana stifled a laugh. Bethesda raised an eyebrow and clucked her tongue.
"Do I look that absurd?" I asked.
"Of course not, Papa," said Diana. "Pay us no attention. We are only teasing you."
Nevertheless, I banished them from the garden, drained of my confidence and feeling more nervous than ever at the prospect of wearing the toga in public. I set about pacing again, trying to find a gait that felt natural to me. A slave came to tell me that I had a visitor in the vestibule. It was Tyro. I told the slave to show him in. Tyro's jaw dropped when he saw me. He grinned and laughed, and then, with some effort, assumed a more serious expression.
"Gordianus, of course, I've heard the news. But to actually see you, I mean to say, you look quite,
yes, very.
But why shouldn't you? I mean to say, congratulations."
"Thank you, Tyro. Does Cicero send his congratulations as well?"
Tyro skirted the question. "No other man in Rome is more deserving of the honour than you. I mean that sincerely. Yes, there may be some who complain or express doubt. It may take some getting used to. Even Cicero, perhaps."
"Just how bad a tantrum did he throw when he heard the news?"
"Tantrum? I'd hardly call it that. He did throw a rather heavy bronze stylus at one of the slaves, and almost blinded the fellow. But he felt terribly sorry afterward. But never mind. Every senator in Rome, all of them, including Cicero, shall be won over by your dignity and gravitas, I've no doubt. Just look at you. Born to wear that toga, I would say."
"Clothes make the man, as Plautus says."
"Exactly."
Tyro flashed a crooked smile. To be honest, I was afraid you might turn up wearing something, well, something not quite, that is to say, not all togas are equal, and to obtain a really fine one, especially at short notice. Where did you get that toga?
That, Tyro, is a state secret. To reveal the source of my toga would compromise not only myself, but also a high-ranking magistrate of the Roman people. I shall say no more.
You know I could find out if I really wanted to.
I'm sure you could. You and Cicero must have a network of informers second only to Fulvia.
Now, that woman does set the standard for spycraft. But that brings me to the purpose of my visit.
He lowered his voice.
Have you anything to report to me, Gordianus? I know you've been out and about the last few days, paying calls on various people, Fulvia included.
Yes, I made it seem that I was testing the waters, seeing how those various people would react to my impending appointment.
And while doing that, did you also happen to learn anything that might be of interest to Cicero, regarding the matters the two of you discussed?
I grunted. Caesar will outlive us all, I suspect.
You detect no current of anger or resentment against him? No thread of envy or spite? No tide of discontent?
No such current or thread or tide by themselves ever killed any man, far as I know. Of course there are those who might wish Caesar gone, if they could do so by snapping their fingers. The world would suddenly be quite a different place, wouldn't it? A better place, in Cicero's judgment, don't deny it. Cicero accepts the dictatorship and conducts himself accordingly. I'm sure he does. Holding himself up and writing dissertations on divination, of all things. How he must long for the days of great speeches in the courts and fiery debates in the Senate. How he must wish that the dead republic could be brought back to life. But I've never seen a dead body get back on its feet. Tyro sighed.
Then Caesar is safe. No one will be brave enough or mad enough to change the course laid out for us by the fates.
The fates always have surprises in store, Tyro, as this garment demonstrates. I felt the weight of the toga wrapped around me and sensed the elegant rise and fall of the folds as I shrugged.
Wait a moment. That's why Cicero decided to devote all his energies to a study of divination, isn't it? Not to debunk it, but to see if, in fact, there might be some supernatural means of seeing the future, of discovering where and how and by what means the thread of Caesar's life will reach its end. Instead, Cicero found nothing in divination to help him, so he turned to me. That would bring us full circle, wouldn't it? Taking us back to the very beginning of his career, when you and he and I all got the better of that other dictator, Sulla. Oh, Tyro, what your master, forgive me, Cicero, I mean to say, what Cicero needs is a magical spell to rid him of useless nostalgia. Sulla was long ago. Caesar is now. Cicero must learn to live in the world as it is. And what world is that? A world where Caesar is dictator for life, where men forget all those speeches by Cicero that you transcribe so carefully, because the ideas in those speeches no longer make sense. A world where Rome is ruled by a dictator, and that dictator rules an empire bigger than that of Alexander, stretching all the way to Parthia, maybe even to India. A world where Gordianus the Finder is a senator, no less than Cicero, unthinkable as that may be. Tyro shook his head. It seems that neither you nor I have learned anything in the last few days to contradict the future you describe. By every indication, every bit of gossip, every scrap of information I've managed to collect, the future will be as you say. Nothing will happen in the next few days to change it. No person or persons will do anything to change it. There's no conspiracy against the dictator. If there were, then surely Cicero and I would know about it.
There. Your duty is done, Tyro. You have my final report.
Cicero won't like it, but there it is. I know of no imminent threat to the dictator.
We were both silent for a long moment. Tyro finally spoke.
Well then, that's that. But we haven't seen the last of each other. Far from it. I still attend meetings of the Senate as secretary to Cicero. No one can take down spoken words as quickly or as accurately as I can, using my shorthand. Others have learned the method, but I'm still the best. I shall be there on the ice to take down your remarks after Caesar announces your appointment.
My pulse quickened. By Hercules, I hadn't thought of that. I'll have to say something, won't I?
Tyro smiles. No one will expect an immortal speech. Most new senators just say a few words. Honour the ancestors, praise the institution of the Senate, acknowledge friends and allies. Men used to thank the citizens of Rome who elected them to their first magistracy, and thus set them on the course of honour. These days, they give thanks to Caesar, since vote does no longer matter. Then you'll take the oath that's now required of every senator to protect the life of the dictator with your own.
A speech and the oath? With everyone looking at me?
I'm afraid so. Pretend they're not there, that it's just you and Caesar. He's the only man in the chamber who matters anyway. Or picture your fellow senators with animal heads, like those absurd Egyptian deities. I sometimes do that to amuse myself when the speeches are especially long-winded.
I can see I'll be coming to you for advice on a regular basis, Tyro.
I shall be honoured to give the new senator any assistance I can. On an impulse, I stepped forward and embraced him, as I would a son. He returned the embrace, then stepped back.
You really do look quite splendid in that toga, he said.
Thank you. But I'm a bit uncertain about how to carry myself, especially when I'm in the Senate House.
I can help you with that, if you wish.
There was no one whose judgment I trusted more.
I would be very grateful.
Walk to the peristyle and back.
Yes, like that, but a bit slower, and with your shoulders back.
By the time Tyro left, after midday, having been treated to the most lavish luncheon I could put before him, my confidence had returned. Even so, it was with some relief that I took off the toga and put on a simple tunic, suitable for taking a nap in the garden under the mild marsh's sun, with Bast the cat snuggled beside me. Aside from napping, I spent the rest of the day doing very little. It seemed to me that my work was done. I hadn't only obtained the toga I needed, but I also had received expert advice on how to wear it. The investigation assigned to me by Cicero, a task I had never accepted in the first place, had ended with my report, such as it was, to Tyro. The more specific task given to me by Caesar, to look into the affairs of certain men on a list, had reached its end as well. I could give that report to the dictator in person that night at dinner, if he wished. Caesar was notorious for mixing business with pleasure at his meals. Mito had told me of a dinner party in Egypt, where the dictator interrupted an anecdote being told by Cleopatra not once, but three times, to whisper memoranda in Mito's ear, so that Mito could jot down the ideas while they were still fresh in Caesar's mind. But he made sure to laugh quite heartily when the queen finally finished her story, said Mito. He's not ill-mannered. He just has a great deal on his mind. The queen showed not the least displeasure. She's one of the few people on earth who can even begin to understand how great a burden Caesar bears, every moment of every day and night. The day passed without incident, and with no more visitors, until,
As the sun began to sink behind the rooftops of Rome, Mito arrived, wearing a splendid green tunic with gold embroidery. I had chosen to wear a more understated tunic of very dark blue, with a Greek key pattern in white at the hems. The women of the house made a great fuss over us both, and then Mito led me through the vestibule and out the door. "Are we going far?" I asked, stepping into the quiet twilight street and seeing a very large, very fine litter. The cushions and curtains were of a sumptuous fabric with a pattern of checkered black and gold. The slaves assigned to carry it were all very large and fine to look at. Half were black-skinned Nubians with tightly curled black hair, and half were Scythians with white complexions and golden hair. They were interspersed, so that the bearers themselves formed a sort of black and gold checkered pattern around the litter's perimeter. Mito laughed. "We're not going far at all. We dine at the house of Lepidus, who provided the litter. Somehow Caesar has got it into his head that you're an old man and shouldn't be made to walk."
"I'm only 10 years older than Caesar," I said. "Did Caesar think that in 10 years he would be a doddering old man? No wonder he was in such a hurry to conquer Parthia." "Surely no task for an old man," I muttered.
"What did you say, Papa?"
"I said, walking to the house of Lepidus is no task for an old man. Help me into the litter, and let's be off."
Chapter 27 I had never met Marcus Emilius Lepidus, our host. About him I knew only what most Romans would know. He was of patrician birth, about my age, and had been allied with Caesar for a long time. When the civil war began, it was to Lepidus that Caesar entrusted the keeping of Rome while Caesar chased Pompey to Greece. It was Lepidus who put forward the motion that granted Caesar his first temporary dictatorship. Later, Caesar dispatched Lepidus to Spain to quell a rebellion there, and was so impressed that Lepidus was granted a triumph when he returned to Rome. While Lepidus's procession paled compared to the staggering grandeur of Caesar's own 4 triumphs the following year, a triumph is never a small affair, and that of Lepidus had been sufficient to impress his name on the minds of even the least attentive citizens. Currently, he was serving as master of the horse, essentially a deputy of the dictator. On Caesar's departure to Parthia, Lepidus was to leave Rome and become governor of Spain. Among his family connections was his marriage to a half-sister of Marcus Brutus, which united 2 of the oldest and most distinguished patrician clans in Rome. But Lepidus and Brutus had never been political allies. Lepidus had always been loyal to Caesar. Lepidus's house followed the rule of inverse opulence that I had often observed when admitted to the homes of the powerful in Rome. The more austere the exterior, in this case, a very simple white plaster wall fronting the street, and a wooden door without a single ornament, not even a bronze knocker, the more sprawling and opulent the interior. The vestibule, crowded with wax images of ancestors, was the size of my garden. The garden, populated by some notable Greek bronzes, was the size of my house. The dining room, open on one side to the garden, but warmed by 2 massive braziers, was small but exquisitely furnished, with 3 very fine dining couches. On the walls, painted roses bloomed and peacocks displayed shimmering plumage. The 3 long couches were arranged at right angles to one another, with the open side toward the garden. By custom, no more than 2 guests would share a couch, each reclining on 1 elbow head to head. With only 3 couches for 6 guests,
The dinner wasn't to be a grand affair, where a simple guest like myself could recede into the background, but something more like an old-fashioned Greek symposium. There would be a host, a guest of honour to his right on the centre couch, and two pairs of guests on the couches to either side, with food and entertainment arriving from the open side facing the garden. Our host stood at the centre of the dining room. Mito, who had been acquainted with him for years, introduced us. Lepidus was clean-shaven. His full head of silver hair was stylishly cut to look a bit tousled and unkempt, but I had no doubt that each lock had been carefully laid in place by the slave who groomed him. He stepped forward to greet me and clasped my right hand in a firm grip.
Gordianus, father of our esteemed Mito, it's so good to finally meet you. You're something of a legend, you know.
Am I?
Oh, yes. At this dinner, only legends. Well, for guests, I should say. I won't presume to use such a word for myself.
Nor would I for myself, I said.
Humble.
Lepidus nodded thoughtfully.
Yes, Mito says as much. But that's a son speaking about his father. One doesn't expect it to be true. I so often find myself surrounded by men who are the opposite of humble that I forget the virtue actually exists.
If it is a virtue, said Mito, my father has no reason to be humble, not after the life he's led.
The same could be said of you, Mito, Lepidus smiled. I think you must be the only man still alive who actually fought alongside Catilina in his revolt. Now that is a stuff of legend. You rose from slave to citizen, and now you're to be the son of a senator. And then there are your literary achievements, for which you receive no credit whatsoever, though I know for a fact how scrupulously you attend to Caesar's grammar and syntax, not to mention his occasional factual errors.
Oh, yes, Gordianus, even Caesar, like Homer, sometimes nods, and your son is there to ever so gently open his eyes to any small oversight in the text.
Thus are Caesar's memoirs made perfect, before they're copied for an eager readership.
I assure you, Master of the Horse, there's no such thing as a perfect text.
Mito shrugged off the compliment, but I saw that he was pleased by Lepidus's words.
Ah, but I think the man himself is about to join us.
Lepidus looked past us at a slave who was gesturing to him from across the garden.
Yes, oh, not only Caesar, but my other guests as well. They must all three have come in a group.
He clapped his hands. Two slaves seemed to appear from nowhere, each bearing a tray of three silver cups filled with a dark red wine.
That means we can at last quench our thirst. It would have been rude to begin without the guest of honour, and here he is.
Lepidus strode forward across the garden. He embraced Caesar, who was dressed in a shimmering tunic with long sleeves. The fabric was silk, woven in a very complex design. One could see all kinds of colours amid the interwoven patterns. Caesar would later tell us that the fabric came all the way from Serica, beyond India. Once Parthia was conquered and its trade routes claimed by Caesar, we might expect such exotic fabrics to become common in Rome. To Caesar's left stood Decimus Brutus, dressed in a dark green tunic. The woolen garment was gathered at the shoulder with a golden brooch and cinched at the waist with a golden belt. Even at a distance, I could see that the dragon-headed clasps were of Gaulish design. The Gauls have no peers when it comes to such metalwork. To Caesar's right stood Cinna, wearing a white linen tunic without ornament. The belt was of black linen, cinched with a simple silver clasp. When Cinna saw me, he gave me an impish wink, as if to say, "Here we are among the stars, can you believe it?" Lepidus turned about and led the other three toward us. To either side of me, braziers burned. Torches flickered from various sconces in the surrounding portico. The last faint light of day lit the ashen sky
in which the first stars had begun to shine. The four men moved amid green shrubs and tall statues. The ever-changing light, the men in their finery, the looming figures of marble and bronze, all combined in a moment of surpassing strangeness. I looked at Mito, wondering if he, too, felt it. On his face I saw a look of deep contentment that increased with each step that brought Caesar nearer. The two of them embraced. I acknowledged Decimus and Cinna. Mito, stepping back from Caesar, gave each a friendly nod. We were offered wine. I noticed that my cup was exquisitely decorated with an image of Silenus, quaffing wine from a Greek crater, surrounded by wildly cavorting nymphs, dryads, and satyrs. The flickering light on the embossed silver seemed to make the figures tremble ever so slightly, as if alive and merely holding a pose. Of the wine, I remember nothing, nor can I recall any of the food I was served that night. Those details, so vivid at the time, are lost to memory. Yet I remember Silenus and those satyrs on the silver cup, and I remember what each of us was wearing as clearly as if Cinna, Caesar, Mito, Decimus, and Lepidus stood before me, all of us still alive, as we were on that torchlit, starlit night. Before we reclined on the couches, Caesar drew me aside. "The list," he said. I shook my head. "I have nothing to report beyond the comments I made to Mito. That was the day before yesterday." "Yes, he passed along to me the thought you expressed." "I fear I've been of no use to you." "Of no use? Never. Of little use, perhaps. But even an empty report may signify something, or rather nothing, which is what I hope for. Calpurnia will be greatly relieved that the finder found nothing to fear. For some reason she has a very high estimation of your talents." "My talents, such as they are, have usually been employed in finding the truth of some event that's already taken place. I've never claimed to have any talent for prevention or precognition. I can't foretell the future." "No man can. Not even Spurinna, though I know he means well. As I say, your lack of alarm will comfort Calpurnia." "And you as well, Caesar?" "Any worries I may have had are now in the past. I have no fear of anyone on that list I gave you, or of anyone else in Rome, for that matter." He flashed a smile that didn't seem quite appropriate, and in his eyes I saw a feverish glint that was the first indication of the singular mood he was to display throughout the evening. A strange excitability, an animation out of proportion to the moment, an occasional, vaguely manic laughter that set my teeth on edge. No one else seemed to notice these things, not even Mito. I told myself that Caesar was simply excited at the prospect ahead of him, so close now, the conquest of Parthia, and the unprecedented, almost inconceivable power it would give him, the power to marry multiple queens, to sire many princes, to become more godlike than any mortal before him, to be remembered for all time. We took our places on the dining couches. I reclined next to my son, Cinna, beside Decimus, and Caesar beside our host. At first we talked of practical matters. We spoke of my elevation to the Senate and Cinna's solution to my toga dilemma. A great deal was said about the preparations of everyone, except myself, to depart Rome, Decimus to govern Gaul, Lepidus to govern Spain. A full legion was encamped on the Tiber island just outside the city to escort him, Cinna and Mito to travel with Caesar. Cinna had been with Caesar for most of the day. The two of them holed up at Cinna's house. "The only place where I can escape from all other concerns," Caesar explained. to work on the speech that Caesar would deliver to the Senate the next day. This was to be no ordinary oration, but a combined farewell speech and valedictory address, in which Caesar would put forth for posterity his version of the civil war, briefly, so as not to dwell on the past, and his vision for the future of Rome as a capital city of the world, not Alexandria or Troy, as some rumours had reported. The speech, Caesar declared, was a masterpiece, thanks in no small part to the contributions of Cinna. "This is to take nothing away from you, Mito," Caesar said. "You helped with the initial draft, which shaped the basic arguments, but the final version required a poet's touch, and not just any poet, but our own dear Cinna, the greatest poet alive. Cinna, you blush, or is it that the brazier's flames reflected on your cheeks?" Here Caesar delivered one of those laughs that set my teeth on edge. "I say it without hesitation, you know, that you are our greatest poet. A month ago, I might not have done so. But a month ago, I hadn't yet read your Orpheus and Pentheus." "The great work is at long last finished, then?" said Lepidus. "It is," said Caesar. "And I was honoured to be the first reader." "And so far, Caesar, you are the only reader," said Cinna, whose cheeks were still flushed. "And what is the judgment of Caesar?" asked Lepidus. "My opinion I will gladly share with you, but you can judge for yourselves, because Cinna has agreed to recite the poem in its entirety this evening." "Hear, hear," said Lepidus, clapping his hands. Decimus did likewise, though it was hard to imagine him a connoisseur of poetry. And so did Mito, though less enthusiastically. I think Mito was a little jealous of Cinna. Over the years I have observed that every writer seems to be jealous of all other writers. "The very conception of the poem is brilliant," said Caesar. "One wonders why no poet thought to do it before. To recount in a single poem the deaths of both Orpheus and Pentheus, so similar in some respects, so different in others. I think you may have created a genre, Cinna, for surely others will follow your example, historians as well as poets. Imagine a series of life stories told in parallel, to compare and contrast the careers and fortunes of great men. I foresee a poem combining Alexander and Caesar," said Lepidus, flashing a knowing look at Cinna. "Perhaps," said Cinna, "if I am so fortunate as to follow in Alexander's footsteps side by side with Caesar, I pray the muse will grant me the inspiration and longevity to express the wonder and the glory of both expeditions, then and now, and perhaps in parallel as you suggest, Lepidus." "I like that bit about longevity," quipped Mito. "The Smyrna did take you almost 10 years to write, and so, I gather, did the Orpheus and Pentheus?" "But surely it won't take 10 years for Caesar to conquer the East," said Lepidus. "You must learn to write faster, Cinna, faster." "No, no," said Caesar. "One cannot hurry perfection. Let Cinna take whatever time he needs to create his masterpieces. The world will be forever grateful." "You flatter me, Caesar," said Cinna. "No, I do not." Caesar sounded almost angry. His eye glittered with manic fire. "Caesar flatters no one. Caesar has no need to. I surround myself with men of supreme ability. If they disappoint, I discard them. If they match or exceed my expectations, I give reward and encouragement, but never flattery. So when I speak highly of your poetry, Cinna, I mean every word I say. If anything, I understate my high regard. As an orator, I've trained myself to avoid the appearance of hyperbole. So let me be clear and speak without equivocation." He drained his wine cup, handed it to a slave, and gestured to another who produced the scroll. The ornate dowels were carved from ivory with inlays of carnelian and caps of gold. When you gave me this copy of the Orpheus and Pentheus, you told me it is the only copy in existence. I felt a grave responsibility to have in my keeping a thing so precious and rare. I began to read it as soon as I had a spare moment, thinking to read only a little and then get back to work. The moment grew to hours. I couldn't put it down, nor could Mito pry it from my hands.
"It's true," said Mito. "I had to turn away one visitor after another. From the very first words, I felt a curious premonition, a stirring of something like fear."
"You, Caesar, fearful?" said Cinna.
"Yes. So dreadful a thing it is to explore the inmost secrets of such stories. Think of the Smyrna and the secrets it reveals." Nor did this feeling diminish as I proceeded. It deepened into a sort of terror, almost a horror of what might come next. Fierce, fiery, incandescent, a firestorm of words ablaze with dazzling images, words that conjure utter ecstasy and utmost despair. I trembled, as one must in the presence of such a singular masterpiece. There is nothing in the whole length and breadth of Latin literature with which to compare it, not even the Smyrna. Whatever great works you've given us before, Cinna, the Orpheus and Pentheus outshines them with a furious brilliance. There followed a long silence. Caesar's listeners sat stunned and speechless. I looked from face to face. Most stupefied of all was Cinna. He had blushed before, but now looked ashen. His hand trembled so violently that he had to put down his silver cup. I thought he might be ill. Then he put his face in his hands and began to weep, as men do when overwhelmed with joy.
Chapter 28. By custom or instinct, one doesn't closely observe other men when they bathe or eat or weep, especially when they weep. Taking my eyes from Cinna, I gazed at the nearby statues in the garden. Situated atop a marble pedestal not far from the dining room, there happened to be a rather magnificent statue of Orpheus. The handsome youth was depicted as usual, wearing a Phrygian cap and holding a lyre, surrounded by numerous animals. The son of the muse Calliope and a mortal king, Orpheus had been revered for centuries as the greatest musician who ever lived, able with his songs not only to charm birds, beasts, and fish, but also to inspire trees and rocks to dance, and rivers to change their course. When his beloved Eurydice died from the bite of a viper, Orpheus descended into the realm of Pluto, using his music to charm the watchdog Cerberus and the ferryman Charon. Even the god of the dead was susceptible. After hearing Orpheus sing, Pluto agreed to relinquish Eurydice, but there was a condition. Orpheus, ascending from the underworld, mustn't look at his beloved until both of them emerged in the world of the living. Orpheus ascended, step by step, playing his lyre so that Eurydice could follow. But she uttered no response to his song. He listened for her footsteps, but couldn't hear them. In an agony of doubt, he dared to look back. Their eyes made contact, they reached for each other, and then Eurydice tumbled back, back, back to the underworld, never to be seen by Orpheus again.
That was the most famous story about Orpheus, but there were many more. His songs, handed down through countless generations, were now known to only a handful of initiates. These special acolytes, keepers of the Orphic mysteries, were said to possess magical powers. As I was soon to learn, Cinna's poem dealt only in passing with the life of Orpheus. The singer's gory death was its chief concern. Of Pentheus, the other subject of Cinna's poem, there was no image in Lepidus's garden. Indeed, I had very seldom seen Pentheus depicted by statues or paintings, only by actors on the stage. How actors love to play a doomed man driven mad! But there was, not far from the Orpheus, facing it in fact, a statue of Bacchus, the god whom Pentheus so gravely offended that he was punished with a fate almost too horrible to imagine, a death in many ways similar to that of Orpheus. The statue depicted Bacchus as a voluptuous youth with a handsome face that betrayed no emotion whatsoever. His brow was wreathed with ivy, and his shoulders clothed with a mantle of grapevines heavy with fruit. Wine, or, more precisely, the wild intoxication that comes from wine, was a gift to mankind of Bacchus, who inspires not only drunkenness, but all manner of madness and frenzy. For centuries, women have been known to worship Bacchus in secret. No man knows the exact nature of these rites, which are said to turn sane women into maenads, mad creatures clothed in animal skins, who run headlong through the woods playing shrill music, singing ululating songs in praise of Bacchus, attacking and annihilating any living creature they encounter. Maenads are the stuff of nightmares, for men at least. The word is Greek for raving ones. In Latin, we call them Bacchantes, after Bacchus, and so they were often referred to in Cinna's poem. I knew the tale of Pentheus mostly from the famous play by Euripides. Young Pentheus, king of Thebes, was so disgusted by the behavior of the local Bacchantes, including his own mother, that he banned the worship of Bacchus altogether. But no mortal dishonors a god without consequence. Bacchus decided to wreak a particularly terrible vengeance on Pentheus. Looking at the statue of Bacchus in the garden of Lepidus, youthful, serene, the giver of wine and joyful abandon, it was hard to imagine such a benevolent divinity inflicting such cruelty. Regaining his composure, Cinna spoke, drawing my attention away from the nearby statues in the garden. "After words that do me such honour, Caesar, I hesitate to utter a single verse of my poem aloud, for fear that I must surely disappoint my listeners." "Nonsense, Cinna," said Caesar. "These men will fall under the poem's spell as surely as I did. Recite to us now. Do you require the written words?" He gestured to the scroll with its ornate ivory dowels. Cinna shook his head. "I've labored so long over every word, the verses are engraved in my memory." He rose from his couch and stepped to the outer edge of the dining room, standing almost in the garden, so that he was framed by the moonlit statue of Orpheus on one side and Bacchus on the other, with his own face brightly lit by the flaming braziers. The placement of poet and statues was so ideal, so theatrical, it seemed almost contrived, not mere coincidence. But by whom? Not by any of the men present, I thought. By the fates, perhaps. As when Cinna had recited for me the ending of the Smyrna, I was again spellbound by his voice. The timbre, the cadence, the flood of words, words beautiful and terrifying, uplifting and appalling, majestic and overwhelming, sometimes seeming to come from a great distance, like heavenly pronouncements,
and at other times as intimate as a whispered kiss upon the ear.
Caesar was right to praise him, I thought, but what sinner had wrought was beyond praise. It was like a thunderstorm or avalanche or raging flood, a phenomenon overwhelming to mortal senses, demanding complete attention but beyond human judgment. Caesar was also right in saying that the new poem was greater than the Smyrna, not merely greater, but 10 times greater, dwarfing anything any Roman poet had done before. The story of Orpheus was briefly recounted, his gift for music, his journey to the underworld, his loss of Eurydice. Then Cinna came to the death of Orpheus. Beside the banks of the Hebrus River, attempting to console himself for the loss of Eurydice, Orpheus devised the most beautiful of all his songs, a song of lamentation, but also of deep and endless love, love that transcended time and death. So compelling was his song that all creatures stopped to listen. Lions and lambs alike gazed at Orpheus, their eyes brimming with tears. The trees bent toward him, striving to embrace him with their leafy branches. Rocks, enraptured, rose into the air, arranged themselves in fantastic shapes, and swayed to the rhythm of his verses in a kind of dance. Only maenads were immune to his music. A group of Bacchantes rampaging through the woods came upon Orpheus as he sang. They covered their ears and shrieked, for the sweet music threatened to draw them out of their frenzy, to tame them, as it had all other creatures, and even the elements themselves.
"See, see the man who scorns us!" cried one of the Bacchantes.
She hurled a spear at Orpheus, but being made of wood, the spear fell prostrate before the singer, then rose before him and twirled about, dancing in time to his song. Another Bacchante reached for a stone and hurled it at Orpheus, but the other stones formed a wall to block its passage, so that it recoiled and fell to the ground, then rose up and joined its fellow stones in the dance. The furious Bacchantes began to howl, and those with instruments, flutes, tambourines, braying horns, drums made from animal hides, created such a din that even the song of Orpheus was drowned by the discord. Now the stones could no longer hear his song, and neither could the wooden spears. The animals that surrounded Orpheus scattered and fled, the rocks fell to the ground, the trees drew back. The howling Bacchantes surrounded Orpheus. They pelted him with stones, beat him with sticks, stabbed him with spears. Still he sang, though now only the Bacchantes could hear. His song became a cry for mercy, a song that would make even Medusa weep. But the Bacchantes were unmoved. They laid hold of him and began to gouge his flesh. They tore off the hands that played the lyre so lovingly. They tore off his arms and legs. Some of them bit into the quivering flesh still warm with blood, while their sisters chanted a hymn to Bacchus Carnivorous, eater of raw flesh, an ancient name of the god no one alive dared whisper, except the Bacchantes. Still Orpheus sang. They gouged his neck with sharp fingernails and ripped his head from the body. Into the Hebrus they threw his lyre and his head. His lips still murmured, his tongue still moved, but no sound issued from his breathless mouth to charm the river that carried him swiftly to the sea. A wave chanced to toss his head onto the lyre, which cradled it as gently as a pillow. As the head, lifeless now, rolled over the strings, the motion produced the strangest and most mournful music ever made.
with no mortal to hear it. At last, the lyre and the head were tossed upon the sand